Your feel must be confirmed by the price action. But what is most interesting about these patterns is that there is no money trying to catch the bottom for a new trader and most experienced traders. 1. You will be wrong sometimes and take huge rips when the stock is not at the bottom. 2. Even if you catch the bottom, you will be unsure whether it is the bottom. This will cause you to sell too quickly, too often. A stock often looks the worst at the bottom. There will be signs of weakness near the bottom. The sellers are still concerned with dumping their shares, and buyers are still cautious to take a big position. And when you see this weakness, you will most likely sell too early into the beginning of the bounce and thus miss the huge up move. The money trading a bounce is in waiting for the stock to bottom, seeing the stock hold higher, and then getting long. Also, if the stock is going to bounce, let the stock breathe when it first starts to trade higher. ROH traded up 2.5 points, found some support at 50, and then traded 4 points higher. You want to be in the move from 50 to 54. This is where the easy money is. This is where your win rate is 60 to 70% with an upside of at least 5 and a downside of 1. This is a play where you will consistently make money. Now, there are some experienced traders who pick bottoms, and they play these stocks for retracements. This is for experienced traders, and this is a very difficult trading technique. Even for an experienced trader, I would suggest following trends. There is more money to be made, and your results will be more consistent trading with the trend of stocks in play. You will see chart patterns like ROH again. Let the stock stabilize and hold higher. Then, and only then, should the new trader get long. And then let the stock run. Do not sell at the first sign of weakness. Play for a bigger chop than normal. After these historic bounces, everything was about to change. Everything, and for all of us. 9/11. I lost $36,000 trading CMRC in the late spring of 2001. I was studying technical analysis at the time and using my new knowledge to buy into technical support levels. Boy, was this an expensive lesson. Support levels from the internet boom turned out to be no levels at all, as the bubble was bursting. This is a common mistake developing technicians make. There might be a support level on a chart, but the would-be technical traders fail to consider the overall psychology during the period when this support level was created, and if this psychology is still intact. If not, forget about that support level holding up. Despite the CMRC losses and some other rips I had taken, I decided it was time for me to take a break. I had given back close to $75,000 for the year just before that summer, and that was real money to me. I was still flush from capturing the benefits of one of history's greatest trading eras, so I decided, along with Steve, to hit the road. I still did not have shorting skills, but I was exhausted from the internet bubble. It was time for me to get away and work on my golf game. Steve and I traveled and played tons of golf. We went wherever we wanted, Vegas, Palm Springs, Santa Monica, Portland. We stayed wherever we wanted, the Venetian, Mondrian Hotel, La Quinta. We ate where we wanted, Nobu, Asia de Cuba, Sparks, 4th Street. We did whatever we wanted. Probably best if I leave out all of those details. And yet we still had plenty of money. My grand goal for that summer was to break 90. And I did that at PGA West in Palm Springs just before we headed home. I decided I would head back to work on 9/11/01. The fun ended real quickly. I got off the subway downtown that morning, and there was all this commotion. I looked up at one of the World Trade Center buildings, and it was in flames. I started to walk toward the World Trade Center as this was on the way to our trading office on Broad Street. Within moments, I saw a huge plane crash into one of the towers. Come to find out, this was the second of 2 planes to crash into the towers that day. I turned and sprinted toward the South Street Seaport. My sunglasses flew off my head, lost to the ground as I turned and ran as fast as I could. I did not need anyone to tell me what was happening. A few clear thoughts hit me as I sprinted away from the carnage and dust. Do not use the subway. Stay away from the Empire State Building. Stay off your cell phone so the phone lines are not overflooded. Get uptown. I soon found Broadway and followed it all the way up to the Upper West Side, about a 5-mile journey. I received a call from a friend and quickly stated that I was okay and got off the line. Once I got to the neighborhood, I calmly walked up to Sarah Beth's on Amsterdam near West 81st Street. I sat down and ate an egg white, goat cheese, and spinach omelet with fresh brewed iced tea and lime. In seminal world-changing moments such as this, you remember every detail, even if you have a generally poor memory. I really didn't know what else to do. I was just trying to stay out of the way. The markets did not reopen until the next week, Monday, September 17th, a near miracle spearheaded by the tireless efforts of then NYSE chairman Dick Grasso. All while Grasso and his minions and peers worked sleepless nights to get the market machines up and running, there was talk of future attacks. There were concerns about the air quality downtown. Should we go back to work? We thought. Now, if you have not gleaned by now, I am analytical. If you send me to buy a loaf of bread, it might take me 5 minutes to find the right loaf. But the decision to go back received zero contemplation from me. Most on the street felt like I did. Fuck them, was the general sentiment among all my peers. I'm going back to work. I am not a fireman or a cop who ran into one of those burning buildings, and I never served in the military. The least I could do was go back to work and prove to the perpetrators of this most hateful act that they were not going to win this battle. For the first few weeks, we wore mask filters on the walk to work because the air downtown was contaminated. There were checkpoints near the New York Stock Exchange, which I needed to pass to get to Broad Street. You needed to present your license and a letter of employment to the military guards. The guy checking my identification had an M16 strapped to his shoulder. Bomb-detecting dogs patrolled the area. This was a new Wall Street. The markets were still weak. I grounded out each day, reinvigorated by my time away and the recent events. I scalped the crap out of the market, unsure what direction it would turn next. Focusing on the next 50-cent trade, sometimes scalping. We were in the office watching tape one Saturday when an interesting trading topic emerged: when to forego a scalp. There is this notion that day traders just scalp. Wrong. Actually, we rarely scalp these days. But there is also this elitist belief that scalping is somehow beneath some traders. Not me. When I take my check to the bank at the end of the month, they do not ask, "Hey, did any of that money come from scalping?" They cash my check. As a trader, I ask, "Can I find a trade that offers me an edge?" And sometimes a scalp offers me an edge, so I scalp. However, as day traders, we can fall victim to overscalping. Scalping should just be one trade of many in our quiver. And scalping should not be our focus, especially in this market. If G-Man catches you doing this on the desk, he will call you out. I can hear him lecturing. "Stop trading like a piker day trader. That is not what we do here." Most importantly, we cannot let a scalp trade interfere with our main objective, and that is to find the next 50-cent trade. If a scalp will alter our focus such that we can make a quick 7 cents but miss the next 50-cent trade, then this is a poor trade. Also, scalping against the trend with really strong or weak stocks is not advisable. Scalps are for stocks that are not clearly directional. When a stock is really trending, we want to focus on where to load up with the direction of the trend. We want to focus on a big trade. Wasting mental energy on 7 cents is not a good use of our time with a clearly trending stock. But as we poke around with a stock sometimes, especially on the open, a scalp can be the proper trade. Sometimes we must scalp a stock on the open on the short side and long side to get a feel for the stock. This scalping often helps us identify the stock's important intraday levels. Often by trading in and out, we spot the next excellent 50-cent trade. During our review session, we were watching GES. Our trader made a scalp trade at 52 cents to 64 cents. I barked, "Stop the tape." I was concerned that this trader was not focusing on the big picture, the next 50-cent trade. He was. My bad. He recognized that the short at 64 cents was the trade that offered the most likely next 50-cent trade. So he got short. He scalped the 52-cent to 64-cent trade and then had the mental agility to start a short position. This is excellent trading, but not everyone has this superior mental agility. And if you don't, then you can't make that 52-cent to 64-cent scalp trade. All you can do is make the short at 64-cent trade, because you should be focusing on that next 50-cent to $1 trade. This is the trade that you can't miss. In October 2001, my dad and I watched from our season seats at Yankee Stadium as President Bush threw out the ceremonial pitch for Game 3 of the World Series. We were all just trying to do the things we had normally done, like going to a ball game. The president threw a strike wearing a FDNY jacket as F-16 fighter jets buzzed the stadium. This was all new for the nation. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer stated the president was helping to do what all Americans are doing now, which is keeping the country doing what it typically does at this time of year. But as a trader, I knew I had to get better. The market demanded that I develop. The internet bubble had burst, the bounces were over, and a very difficult market was here to stay for a while, not to make any significant moves for years. The market has ebbs and flows, and this ebb was a long, difficult slog. It was time to either get better or go home. A bearish cycle in the early 2000s. Many traders claim that you improve more during a difficult market than one ripe with opportunity like I saw my first few years. I totally agree. During the bearish cycles of 2002 and 2003, I didn't make a ton of money, but I became a much better trader and started developing the trading system that I preach today. It was then that I began concentrating on the stocks in play concept. I learned how to make money even when the headlines were not flooded with breaking news. I was ultra-consistent, making money in 17 out of 20 trading days per month. Every day I found one stock with fresh news and made decent profits. I soon learned that these in-play stocks were easier to trade than the JDSUs and AMZNs of yesteryear, and that their technical levels were cleaner. From 2003 to 2006, the market had stabilized and we traded in a range. In the process, I taught myself how to fade stocks. I would find a stock in play and short it when it was too strong and buy it when it was too weak. The trades weren't nearly as exciting or as sexy as the late 1990s, but I had adapted accordingly and was still able to grind out daily profits. Some of my peers never made the mental leap. Lost lots of money, lost their over-leveraged homes, and left the business, or at least blew up enough backers to be forced into switching to the sell side. Thanks to my humility and ability to reinvent myself as a trader, I never had to do that. By concentrating on fading a stock, I became an absolute expert in reading the tape. I wanted to fade my stocks at the tops and bottoms of the moves and eliminate almost all of my risk. And to catch the bottom and top of the moves in order to fade takes extreme concentration and absorption of a stock's prints. My tape reading skills on the market improved every day during this difficult 2003 to 2006 period. It got to the point where someone could show me a stock I had never seen or heard of, not know a thing about, and I could still make money. All I needed was to watch it trade for 20 minutes. All because I spent day after day learning a skill, reading the tape, that had been forgotten for decades. During these range-bound years, we were reinventing ourselves. Critics might say that our fast-living peers got their comeuppance in the early 2000s, but the reality was, we went to work every day like everyone else and tried to make a consistent living. Call it blue-collar trading, and it felt like that. Instead of building the proverbial skyscraper in a day, we were building houses brick by brick for several years, waiting for better times to come and improving our trading skills. So what happened to those opportunities from the late 1990s? Okay, maybe we won't see them again, but there has to be better trading than 2001 to 2002. And better trading came. Only because I reinvented myself during these lean markets of 2003 to 2006 by learning the new trading technique of fading and grinding out profits, could I enjoy the swing and momentum markets that returned in 2007 to 2008. To offer more perspective on this time in the markets, here is a blog I wrote titled, A Fade Trade. A Fade Trade. During our video review session today, we watched some tape of TGT. One of our experienced traders, NYU, faded target into its second up move on the open at 33.75. There was a struggle at 33, and the buyers won, sending TGT quickly to 33.80. See figure 12.2 on your bonus material. NYU thought the move was overdone and got short. This was a poor fade trade. One that I see new traders make too often and shouldn't. Let's discuss. First, some advice before I begin. We do not let new traders fade when they first begin trading with SMB. If you are a new trader, learn this trade after you have established yourself as a profitable trader in today's momentum market. These are difficult trades. Most scouts preach that it takes 1,500 at-bats in the minors to develop into a major league hitter. This is kind of how I feel about fading. You need a ton of experience first. Stick with support and resistance plays first. Things I do not like about this fade. The win rate was too low. The risk reward was poor. There was no way to tell where the top would be at this moment. I only fade a stock that is at least 2 standard deviations from its correct temporary price, and it was way too early to determine this. It was just too early to fade without historical knowledge, and TGT was still in an uptrend. Best Buy rallied after its earnings, and now here was another retailer bouncing on the open. It was just wrong. To be a great fade trader, you must make thousands of fade trades, and that one was just not right. As much as I have conceptualized my reasons here, the trade just didn't look right on the tape. When you fade, your upside must be 5 with a downside of 1. With this trade, NYU's downside was probably 1.23 cents with an upside of maybe 40 cents. TGT showed no signs of a top. In fact, it was in the middle of only its second move. The potential intraday top of TGT at this moment was much higher, possibly 35. This is not the ratio we are looking for. Further, his win rate for this trade was probably 40%. The tape did not offer any evidence that TGT was about to trade lower. I do not trade unless I conclude my win rate is 80%. I only fade when I have determined a stock is at least 2 moves away from its correct temporary price. This is based upon my experience as a trader and examination of the stock intraday. But to determine this, I must either have watched it trade the past few days, which NYU had done, or get a feel for TGT on this trading day. And it was way too early to have a feel for TGT at that moment. So we could not determine that TGT was at least 2 moves from its correct temporary price at this moment. We could discuss fade trading for hundreds of blogs. Hey, maybe we will. I survived 2004 and 2005 by fading. I really learned how to fade during these years. Some were forced out of trading because they could not adapt. But check out the charts from 2004 and 2005 and compare them to today's. You do not want to focus on fading today. This is a momentum trader's market. There are fading opportunities, and I make my share of fade trades in this market, but again, this should not be your focus. And as a new trader, you should not be focusing on one of the harder trades with a market where it is wiser to follow the momentum. This is a great trade to master. You're going to need this trade at times, but not when you are a new trader. and not with this market. Adapting by cutting out negative influences. During the bearish cycle of the early 2000s, I sat next to a good friend, Josh Florsheim, who traded OIH and ETF tracking oil service companies every day. Many traders will relate to his story. At the time, he was in a horrendous romantic relationship. In short, the girl he was dating was insane. At 9:31 a.m., right after the bell had rung, and after a night of fighting, she would call to pick a fight. Josh: honey, I'm trading right now. I'll call you later. Click. At 9:35 a.m., the phone we shared would ring again as our eyes were glued to the screen at the most volatile time of the day. Josh would still pick up the phone. Josh: honey, I'm sorry, I really can't talk now. I will call you later. Click, but quieter this time. Of course, she would call back a few minutes later. Bella: will you please stop calling? We are trading. Slam. Obviously, there was no way for poor Josh, or me, or our entire desk, to concentrate on trading. Often, when I made assessments to improve my trading and cut out distractions, it dealt with cutting down on drinking or learning how to read charts or the tape better. I never thought that dumping my friend's girlfriend would be one of them. So I took matters into my own hands. During some downtime, I was looking at some pictures of a night out with my sister and her friends. When I showed them to Josh, he quickly asked, "Who is that?" referring to one of my sister's friends. Bingo! Our problem would soon be solved. I told Josh I could set him up with this young lady if he wanted. Thankfully, he was in. Fortunately for all parties involved, the first date went very well. My matchmaking skills were so elite that Josh and my sister's friend are now happily married with a child. Soon enough, we all went back to making money. Conclusion: bad relationships can ruin your trading results. In this case, adapting did not mean learning a new style to trade, but rather cutting out negative personal influences. While I'm no Dr. Phil, if the dynamics of a romantic relationship turn sour, so too can your P&L. Always save money. I learned another valuable lesson during these difficult trading years. Save. Whenever you have a great stretch as a trader, save. Save for the difficult times. The markets of the late 1990s did not last. The fall of 2008 was not going to last. I think back to those $15,000 credit card bills, and I learned a valuable lesson. When the VIX was above 60 during the financial meltdown, we knew these days could not continue. Today, I have a very modest budget. I do not spend more than $3,000 a month, ever, which is no easy task in the New York City region. No matter how bad the market gets, I know I can make enough to cover my bills. And if I need something, I must have a ridiculous month before I buy this new thing. During the huge days of 2008, I bought an HD TV after a great month, a new mattress after a big month, a new coach after a gigantic month. And that was it. The rest went into my bank account. And it sits there for a rainy day, so to speak. The spread of the penny. As the active trading world has evolved every year or two in my career, a lot of my peers dropped off the radar, unable to make each transition in lockstep. Some were weeded out after the Asian crisis. Some blew up after the dot-coms. Some couldn't learn how to fade the ranges. One more challenge that Steve and I had to overcome was the narrowing of spreads and a switch from a manual market-making system to a hybrid one. When I first started, stocks were quoted in quarters of a dollar, dating back to a quotation system as old as America itself. The New York Stock Exchange was founded in 1792. As such, bid-ask spreads tended to be in quarters and halves. One popular stock from the 1990s, Intel Corporation, usually traded with a 50-cent spread. So, if I made the spread in NTC with 2,000 shares, I made a quick $1,000. Though soon after I started in 1998 through 1999, quotes kept getting halved and spreads got narrower. eighths became sixteenths, also called teenies, or 6.25 cents. Then came 32nds, 3.125 cents. Once we got to 64ths, or 1.5625 cents, it became nonsensical. Pennies were inevitable. So much for making a quick $1,000. With spreads winnowing down to around 3 cents, making the spread on those 2,000 shares meant a quick $60 and change. After commissions, maybe I could go buy a nice dinner that night. I certainly couldn't buy a new pair of Ferragamos as I did in the past. To undercut another trader on our desk by a 64th was called chiseling. We quickly figured out the traders who would do this, and naturally called these cheap bastards chiselers. There was an unwritten rule that you didn't chisel someone on your own desk for a 64th. As always, though, some didn't get the inherent memo. I'll never forget the day someone on our desk tried to pull this stunt and chiseled our head trader. There was no hiding, as we could see who was doing this on our proprietary trading platform. His initials came across on the trade as the perpetrator. Head traders generally have a sizable ego and are not comfortable being ignored. Our head trader quickly walked over to the chisel man's workstation, told him to turn off his computer, and exploded, "Get the fuck off this trading floor. Come back when you are ready to become a real trader, you fucking chiseler." That weasel trader most certainly deserved it. It was as if he showed up the prom king at homecoming. You just don't cut the line like that. So it is with this context that I find it hard to believe that then one day came pennies. And it is just getting worse. Every day I see some market player selling stock, hidden, at a half a penny above the bid. This is not chiseling. This is just called being a jackass. My message? Learn how to trade, chiseler. When pennies appeared in 2001, many were displaced as traders. Market makers used to making an eighth on every trade folded up their operations as their monthly costs exceeded spread revenue. Many said this was the end of intraday trading. Reading the tape was over. This was an exaggeration, if not a flat-out lie. Every big action always has unintended consequences, and going to pennies was no different. As spreads narrowed, the volatility in stocks actually increased. Greg Godsey of Raymond James explained at the time, "Less profit leads to less capital, and less capital leads to less liquidity." When trading moved to pennies, costs actually increased by about 7% on each trade, according to the General Accounting Office. One part of me says, "Can we please go back to trading in eighths?" But the good traders adapted. You have to find a way. And for us, this meant trading more actively, heightened setup selectivity, and learning new patterns that worked best for this new market. Hey, you had a choice. You could have become a whiny ex-trader, pennies make it impossible to make money, or adapted and conquered this new market. Then came hybrid. The bursting of the internet bubble washed out the lesser traders. Pennies sent some more packing, and then NYSE adopted hybrid. This washed out scores of mediocre intraday prop traders. Steve and I traded NASDAQ stocks exclusively until around 2004, before dabbling with NYSE or listed stocks. As a NASDAQ trader, I didn't like how the NYSE specialist could hold my order for almost a minute before he had to execute. The system allowed for the specialist to manipulate the spread in his favor and front-run my order. In 2004, a handful of specialist firms settled with the SEC for $250 million after being accused of stepping in front of customer orders for years. My advantage as an intraday trader is speed, and with this delay, my edge was removed. But nonetheless, we started wading into the waters of listed names. When NYSE went to a hybrid system, where ECNs could compete with the specialist for better prices, we traded NYSE much more. In the first 3 months of 2007, 82% of NYSE volume was executed, automatically compared to 19% pre-hybrid. Hybrid effectively turned the specialist into just another ECN, marginalizing the specialist and opening up more opportunities for someone like myself with electronic trading skills. That is the way it should be. Competition for stocks should be open and fair. Traders with the most advanced trading skills should be most rewarded, not a trader who knows how to manipulate a specialist's order book. When the order flow left the specialist's book, some day traders had trouble adjusting. They were used to trading off of the order flow they could spot from the specialist. Over the years, they had learned how to trade with the different specialists for different stocks, eventually manipulating them. Many day traders could not make the adjustment. Their bread-and-butter plays were eliminated as ECNs made it harder for them to read the tape. For us, it was an ocean of new opportunity. Heck, it was oceans. Now the NYSE stocks traded more like their NASDAQ counterparts. For an experienced NASDAQ trader, trading NYSE with hybrid was a layup. I kept asking, how is this difficult? Now specialists couldn't hold my orders, and I could get stock when I needed it. The hybrid system would reward superior tape reading skills. While traders like me benefited from this evolution, I still find it hard to talk about this period without also recognizing the many who lost their jobs. We certainly felt for those who lost high-paying jobs through the new technology that had swept the NYSE. I can't imagine what it was like for those traders and specialists with families used to living a certain lifestyle whose skills no longer had a market. Specialist firms closed up shop by the dozens. The floor lost thousands of participants. High-earning, middle-aged men, some of whom were running third- or fourth-generation family businesses, had to learn how to reinvent themselves in the latter half of their careers. When CNBC shows camera shots of the floor now, it's more like a museum than an active, bustling center of capitalism. To those in the trading community, a lot of this was very sad. But at the same time, the market should be open and fair. Traders should not rely on market flow as their main source of income. A trader's income should be determined by their own proprietary buy and sell systems and decisions, eating what they kill, so to speak. One-trick pony. I encounter too many traders who just live off of one play. Commonly, this play is as follows. A trader sees a big bid and steps in front, or sees a big offer and steps in front. This is my definition of scalping, which we saw was rampant post 9/11. This is a play that ought to be in your playbook, but it should not be your entire playbook. I met with an ambitious developing trader recently, unhappy with his firm. He reached out to one of our traders and somehow figured out how to parlay that into a meeting with me. His records are solid for a new trader. Bright, good background, realistic learning curve, nice young man. We all liked him. This developing trader is 1 year into his career, and his entire playbook consists of searching for big bids and offers. Obviously, he is very good at this, but this is all he was taught by his first firm. I am hesitant to ever criticize another firm. In fact, I am not even sure this is a criticism, so much as I am just making an observation. This is not trading. It is important to find easy plays for new traders to make when they first start. We have a bunch. A quick history lesson for our listeners. This technique used by the developing trader above is one of the last trades remaining from before hybrid. Traders would search for big NYSE bids and offers and step in front. There was good money finding these plays. But then came hybrid, like an infectious disease for the one-trick pony traders. And then there were so many fewer of these plays. When I first started trading, there was the old high bid join party. Whenever a market player went high bid and was then joined by another bidder, this was a signal to buy, and this play worked for a few years. Then there was the high bid ARCA and higher bid ARCA play that worked for a few years. Of course, my favorite was the MSCO high bid without dropping for 50 straight points in Yahoo play. These plays eventually become obsolete, like the steel shaft driver. Think graphite. One play is not enough. You cannot be a one-trick pony. It's funny because I was talking to G-Man about getting some new filters for big bids and offers for one of our traders, Z-Money, or Mush. He is such the master at this play, remember, that we actually name the trade after him. We say to Mush the play. And G-Man gave me a look that said this to me. Bella, what the hell are you talking about? This is a trading desk. We don't want to expend any energy finding dopey plays like this. We want to find strong stocks and get long, and weak stocks and get short. Go back to writing your dopey book, and leave stuff like that to me, please. Anyway, this is what his look said to me. And I got the point. I understand that this trade works. I understand that there is money with this trade. And I, on occasion, make such a trade. But you cannot make a career off of one trade. Another market was about to premiere. A new trading play would star. A setup that I had not mastered, but needed to. The uptrending market. During the middle of 2006, the market started an uptrend. Finally. At the start of this period, I continued to fade. Stocks I thought were overbought kept trading higher. I struggled at the inception of this new uptrending market. Fading was not working as well. During my end-of-the-month review, this was undeniable. And the patterns were consistent. Strong stocks were finishing near their highs. The market was screaming, "Bella, you need to adapt." These up moves were not like those during the late 1990s, so this was at first a little confusing to me. These stocks were not exploding, so naturally I would conclude that they were not that strong and fade them. Mistake. Instead of moving up 20 points as they had in the dot-com days, they simply trickled higher. Strong stocks moved higher intraday and finished at their highs, though in a subtle manner. And for a guy who remembered the internet bubble, slow is generous. These up moves were snail-like. I would find a strong stock, watch it, and yell, "Go up already!" That made me feel better, but somehow my encouragement would not make it go up any faster. Again, I had to accept that we were in another different market. We were in an uptrending market, but a painstakingly methodical one. Our job was to find strong stocks, buy into pullbacks, and be patient. The market is not concerned with how you would like stocks to trade. Your job is to adapt to what the market is offering. After watching strong stocks sell off for years, it was hard to buy a stock into a pullback. For the previous 3 years, this would have generated losses. But these were the patterns of this market. The range-bound 2003 to 2006 era was over, and we were left with the bulls running out of the gate in slow motion. It was nice to see stocks go up again. We had not seen this since the late 1990s. Believe it or not, this was one of my weaker trading periods. When a stock is strong, I have a bias for it to go up. Who doesn't? I personally prefer a trading strategy with a higher win rate than simply uptrending stocks. It is hard for me to be wrong so many times as a trader. Naturally, I am better at trading plays where my win rate is 70% than 40%. This trade to me is like sitting on the runway for hours waiting for clearance to take off. I know we are going to take off, but I just hate sitting in that cramped plane getting ready in anticipation. Can we take off already? But I had to overcome this and master these trades. This is the most difficult intraday trade. It requires patience, guts, a belief in your system, the ability to be wrong often, and the backbone to hold the stock for its entire move. On our desk, I get the most questions about how to trade this play. And if you can't do this, then the math doesn't work. AGA was a great uptrending trader with the patience of a saint. During this time period, he was the best trader on our desk. He could hold these winners. He liked them moving slowly in his favor. I guess this was best suited for his personality. AGA was passed by lesser traders during momentum periods. But for this year-plus time period, he was the man on our desk. And this is when G-Man joined us, and was not a great time period for his personality. Not enough fast action. The market was different from the up move from the semis and tech stocks I saw as a swing trader in the late 1990s. Those stocks were all in clear uptrends. They moved up at the end of day with bigger spreads and more definable moves. Honestly, these uptrending stocks of 2006 to 2007 were no fun. They moved at all different times, often midday, when I was most interested in eating my lunch. Didn't they know I was eating my lunch? But we adapted, and we added the excellent trading play, buying into pullbacks, to our quiver. Buying on pullbacks. Buying on pullbacks can be difficult to do, but this is a skill that every trader needs to learn to take his game to a new level. Like any other skill, the more you do it, the better you get at it. Following are a few guidelines that have helped me find good entry points as a stock pulls back from a recent up move. I will use the current market we are in for examples of what I am looking for. I will be explaining pullbacks from the long side. I also use the same guidelines to short stocks in a weak market. It helps to be in a trending market, i.e., market is a bull or bear. Know what sectors are leading the market's trend. I like buying market leaders and leaders in the sectors that are leading the market trend, i.e., GS, Apple, FCX, TGT. The point is key. I like to see these stocks pull back to support levels on lower volume. Sometimes the pullback is pretty intense, especially in higher-priced stocks. But as long as the volume is average, or better yet, below average, I stay the course. If this occurs, I am pretty confident that this is still a pullback and not a reversal. I want these leading stocks to pull back to support or key levels. This can mean different things to different traders, depending on their time frame and risk tolerance. To figure out what those levels might be, I like to use the following. Past resistance as support. Price action at certain levels. This can happen anywhere, but it means some kind of unusual held bid or a fight that occurred between buyers and sellers where the buyers won. The stock pulls back to a moving average. I like to use the 14-day, 20-day, 50-day, and 200-day simple moving averages, depending on my time frame. Another key point. After entering into the trade, I like to see the stock go up on volume. Low volume on the pullback, high volume as the stock advances higher. This is a sign of strength. Lastly, and this goes without saying, when I am wrong, I get out of my position. No ifs, ands, buts, or maybes about it. I am not in the business of averaging down. There is a difference between averaging down and buying into a pullback. One makes you money, and the other ends careers. These are guidelines to follow, but keep in mind, not much in the world of trading is black and white. Be aware that pullbacks can be messy and uncomfortable, especially for newer traders. But your ability to recognize good entry points for strong stocks pulling back in an upward trending market will make you more money and help you become a consistent trader. Good luck. Jay Thoma. The housing crisis. I had learned everything, right? I had lasted through the Asian financial crisis, crushed the internet boom, survived 9/11, remade myself during the lean years, and developed a full quiver of trading plays. What else was there to learn? What else could possibly happen? Ha ha, I was about to trade through the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. CFC? MBI? ABK? I can honestly write that I had never traded a share in any of these stocks until the summer of 2007. We were in that ponderous uptrending market since the middle of 2006, and then there was this news about CFC. See figure 12.3 on your bonus material. And it wasn't good. I had learned to trade momentum during the late 1990s, but I had never concentrated on playing the momentum in a stock on the short side. And then came CFC, MBI, ABK. I had to become an expert, and fast. I am not an expert in real estate, though I have learned much about residential and commercial property from watching my father's investments. It did strike me as odd that home prices had risen so dramatically compared to the cost of building materials. Many of my non-trading friends had solid jobs and could only afford a mediocre house in Nassau County. That didn't make sense to me. But it is not as if I noticed stuff like this and started shorting the home builders and the subprime players. John Paulson, I am not. But I did notice CFC gapping down one day. G-Man. Steve, do you see this CFC? Steve. Yeah, what the hell? G-Man. Bad news. Steve. You think? G-Man. What do you think? Steve. I don't know. I'm just going to trade it. G-Man. Bella? Bella. Watch for the bounce. If not, then I'm going to short the crap out of it. NCFC was not bouncing. Sellers held offers and stepped lower. I was not entirely sure exactly why or what was going on yet, but as a trader, I knew what to do. I got short. And I traded these securities on the short side as long as the intraday momentum was down. This was the first period that reminded me of the late 1990s, and it was the first time the traders that we trained on our upstart prop desk started to make serious money. I remember the huge smile on G-Man's face after trading CFC when this news first hit. G-Man's smile said to me, "Oh, so this is what this trading thing is all about. You guys weren't kidding about the money we could make. This is pretty freaking cool." But G-Man had been honing his skills during more difficult markets. He was ready. If we were pitching this movie, it might go something like this. Trader who struggles for a year but develops his craft, meets a beautiful new market, falls in love with it, and has the time of his young life in New York City. G-Man started talking about buying a Ferrari. Given my earlier plea about saving, I had to step in there and nix that idea. And that was a lot of fun. The money available intraday was like the late 1990s again. It had taken almost 8 years, but we had our chances. No more slogging, no more fading, no more buying these boring pullbacks. It was time to sit on the edge of your seat and ride that roller coaster down, grabbing up to $5,000 to $10,000 or more each day in the process. Subprime lenders like CFC collapsed towards single digits, and the bond insurers like ABK and MBI were on their way to losing their AAA rating, not to mention being called out for their sins by prominent hedge fund managers such as Bill Ackman, Jim Chanos, and David Einhorn. But there was more fun to come, and in more than one sector. The prices of oil and gas skyrocket. From January 2007 to July 2008, the price of a barrel of oil exploded from $50 to an intraday high of $147.11. See figure 12.4 on your bonus material. During the summer, I rent a house on the ocean in the Outer Banks of North Carolina with G-Man. Our summer rental sleeps 14 and is 200 feet from the ocean. During the summer of 2008, the weekly rent for our house fell from $8,000 to $2,200, partly because vacationers could not afford the gas in their car for this remote location. Americans were spending a larger share of their income on energy than at any other time since 1986. I had only infrequently traded oil or gas until this phenomenon. I didn't care for the way that oil stocks ticked intraday. It just didn't fit my eye, as a professional golfer might say, about a particular tour stop. Oil stocks tended to break levels and then reverse. This is my kryptonite. Moves like this just leave me frustrated. Almost always, there are better stocks for me to trade. But oil and gas were impossible to ignore during these years, and I had to just get over my animus for these stocks and the way they traded. But they moved differently during these particular months. They moved more like stocks that I preferred. They trended. They respected trading levels. Orders were real. I preferred HK, CHK, VLO as staples during this period. I followed the momentum and I scalped the crap out of them when they were most in play. Sometimes stocks that are not kind to you become easier to trade. When a stock is really in play, they respect levels and trend better. If a sector or a stock is in play, then I will trade it no matter how poorly it fits my eye during normal trading times. Our trading Super Bowl was about to visit. A market that one might see once a century. The near collapse of our banking system was to arrive, ripping the street apart and contemporaneously offering opportunity to nimble equity traders. It was the year of the intraday trader. The near collapse of the U.S. financial industry. During the near collapse of the financial industry, reams of fresh news were available to digest, and I was often not sure how the market would respond. So I just traded. LEH, BSC, JPM, WFC, MER, GS were most profitable, playing the momentum from the short side. If I noticed that the market did not trust a financial company's reassurances, then I traded that stock with a short bias. The trading gods were awoken, offering a market we will all tell our grandchildren about. Instead of discussing some more about the collapse of legendary institutions and how we crushed them on the short side, let's discuss how even the leading financial company plummeted. GS was clearly the best financial company based upon its initial price action. GS had little exposure to the CDO mess, or at least eliminated their exposure ahead of time. When Warren Buffett invested $5 billion into GS via a purchase of preferred stock to stabilize its down move and provide the bank with liquidity, GS traded higher initially. Buffett also gained the right to purchase shares of GS at $115 any time over the next 5 years. As such, $115 was support for a while after this deal. Naturally, we traded GS on the long side while this support held. But when the street started to question the business model of an investment bank that could leverage itself so heavily with low-interest overnight loans to increase its return on equity for shareholders, GS started to trade below $115. This is when we got short. Once GS broke the Buffett support, it was in deep trouble. See figure 12.5 on your bonus material. GS was able to fall just about anywhere until the shorts were forced to cover. We were not sure of the impact of the news, but we understood our trading levels and followed the downward momentum of the stock. It was one of the simpler rules to follow in my entire career. Above $115, we were long, assuming the intraday trend was up. Below $115, we went short and heavy. During the near collapse of our banking system, we strictly played the momentum of the financials. We often did not know if they would fall lower. Was this the end of our banking system? Or was this all exaggerated, and we were about to put in a bottom? Unsure of what would happen next, and before Congress passed their historic bank bailout on October 3, 2008, we exited when stocks slowed in the direction of their last move. If stocks were ticking down, we whacked the bids, and when these stocks slowed, we covered. If these stocks broke their intraday downtrends, then we got long. The intraday chart in figure 12.5 ought to make you laugh. That was an intraday move in GS, the very best financial stock. And this after history's best investor sunk $5 billion into the company. GS was still removing the CDOs off its balance sheet. In fact, they had shorted them during the down move. Even GS was not immune to the crisis at hand. GS touched 47.41 during its deep dive. Imagine sitting on a trading desk making serious money and thinking, please make this stop. The first part of the down move was interesting, if not fun. But when things got ugly, I wondered what the heck the markets would look like in the future. Would there be markets? Would anyone place his money in securities after this disaster? How much worse could things get? You never know when the market is going to offer one of those historic days. During the internet bubble, there were two memorable days after Thanksgiving, which I showed up for. They were obscenely profitable days that would have been irresponsible to miss. You must sit in your seat as much as possible. Professional traders show up for work every day, just like the rest of the world. they do not miss days because of overly fun activities the night before. They suck it up, come in, sit in their trading seat, and grind it out. After the close, they can rest. During the great markets, you squeeze every nickel you can out of the markets. You never know how long they will last. This was obviously a fantastic trading period. We played the momentum in financials until they stabilized, and then we had a new market to tackle. ETFs explode in popularity. Just as the volatility of financials drew lots of intraday trading capital to the sector, so too did the clever ETF entrepreneurs react to fill this niche. Why trade the strength or weakness of financials at 1x when you can do 3x? And thus, FAS was born. FAS mirrors 3x the long potential of the financial sector, while its counterpart, FAZ, leverages 3x on the short side. For those with slightly less risk tolerance, there is the 2x short financials play of SKF. And for those wishing to pound real estate into the ground, there's SRS, which goes short that sector 2x. And do not confuse that with SDS, which shorts the S&P 500 with a 2x weighting. During the end of 2008 and the start of 2009, these ETFs exploded in popularity. Some on our desk struggled during these months and needed a way to get back on track. In February, I noticed that some had. What were they trading? FAS, FAZ, and all of their leveraged synthetic friends. First, these ETFs are their own animals. They are not companies. They don't have earnings per share or a management team. They are basically tracking stocks that move with more zip. For about 4 months, these traders scalped the crap out of the FAZ, FAS, SKF, SDS, and SRS. They put up some impressive numbers. Many argued that ETFs were a substantial contributor to the market volatility of 2008 to 2009. Some thought it was irresponsible to offer investment vehicles that were leveraged up 3 times, like FAZ and FAS. Isn't this what caused the near collapse of our banking system? As intraday traders, we believe this is a philosophical debate for others. We are not SEC policymakers, central bankers, or economics professors. Let them write a book about that. It is our job to spot patterns, and during this stretch, these ETFs were offering the best trading opportunities. So we traded them. Was it scalping? That was not the issue to me. Our guys were in a slump, and many on the street were struggling. Our guys found a way out, and scalping the ETFs was their solution. I applauded them for digging their way out of a hole and making significant profits after a slump, while most could not make a dime. Trades to hold. In late 2009 and 2010, we refocused our trading strategies again. Now it's trades to hold, longer-term intraday trades, which we developed for another distinct market. The market is uptrending, though with serious economic concerns about the national debt, unemployment, higher taxes, housing foreclosures, a new wave of bad loans, China, a tight credit market, the bailout in Greece, and on and on and on. But every dip is bought. Bad news is shrugged off and the market and stocks head higher. Many individual stocks gap down, bounce, and finish positive. Whenever the bears announce the next down leg or the start of a double-dip recession, in come the bulls pushing the market higher, like thugs stealing a weaker kid's meal money. So we spot inflection points, intraday levels, and find ways to take positions following the trend of stocks. We hold for bigger intraday moves. Our traders are concentrating on bear and bull flags, consolidation plays, and longer-term support and resistance trades. One of our best traders said recently, "I am exclusively concentrating on trades to hold." We are leaning on technical analysis a touch more, which works well in a trending market. We have recently started holding overnight positions again. Let's call them 3-day trades. We have become less active as traders. We build positions and trade around them. G-Man is like a mini PM as I write, with 30 open positions. Steve is talking more these days like a hedge fund manager. Rim is the weakest of all the tech and a potential short candidate. Now it's all finding the trading patterns for trades to hold that work best. That is, until the next market. It's called trading. To last in this business, you must reinvent yourself, tweak your profitable setups, and embrace the mindset of change. If you do this, your reward will be improved trading skills and a larger bank